But in simpler times, John C. Calhoun and Jackson fought it out. I guess we can go back to that. What we were looking at is, let me kind of repaint this scenario. In the 1824 election, who was Jackson's running mate? John C. Calhoun, yes. And Calhoun won. Jackson did not, Calhoun did, so he became vice president. 4 years later, JQA the president and Jackson ran against each other again. Calhoun, the sitting vice president, ran with Jackson again against, by that time, a confirmed different party, the National Republicans under John Quincy Adams, and won again. And so it was Calhoun's strategy to be the vice president twice and be the natural tap to heir to the throne to follow Jackson. Maybe vice president three times for that matter. But at the same time, somebody else had kind of wiggled their way into the situation, and that was Martin Van Buren, who was given the Secretary of State role. So in the history of presidential succession, everyone who had moved from one position to the presidency either come through the vice presidency like John Adams did with Washington, or as all those other Virginians had done, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and John Quincy Adams, the Secretary of State. So there is, it is evident that both Van Buren in the Secretary of State role and John C. Calhoun in the vice presidential role are hoping to win not only the favor of Jackson, but of the party, to be future heir to the party, presidential candidate. And so there was no doubt from the very beginning this kind of friction and jealousy between the two. And in the and three things that I mentioned will divide Jackson and Calhoun. First one being the Peggy Eaton affair, the second being the Crawford letter, and the third one we're going to go into here pretty soon is how a whole tariff controversy split the two apart. And Van Buren was quite crafty at working all three to his advantage. We saw how he did so in the Peggy Eaton affair by offering to be one of the cabinet members who resigns and takes a different post in order to get the Eatons out of town and help Jackson have some political cover. Also still related to Van Buren is the Crawford letter. Crawford himself now after the stroke is a retired politician, but he still has, he wants to be connected to somebody of power, which can be Van Buren, if his letter to Jackson can cause more disfavor with Calhoun by accusing Calhoun of being the one back in the cabinet meetings who called for his court-martial when he hanged the British in Florida. This is all review, right? Not one nod, so. Okay. So this brings us up then to the third incident, and that is in item 48, how troubles over the tariff controversy arose. Well, to set our stage here, the tariff of 1828 was nicknamed what?
Tariff of Domination.
Because?
Nobody liked it.
So in somebody's mind, it was too what?
People wanted a tariff, didn't like it because it also included a tariff on raw goods.
Yes.
The people that didn't want a tariff were upset that they passed this one at all.
That it was too high, yeah, that it was higher than the previous one. So one state expressed its disgust so much that it issued a nullification declaration, or it could nullify if they wished declaration. Who was that?
South Carolina.
And we would later find that who wrote it for South Carolina?
Oh, okay.
Calhoun himself, the sitting vice president, while a vice president, is secretly writing a document that says states can defy executive authority. Who was his role model, though?
Jefferson,
in fact, with the Kentucky Resolution doing the same thing in 1798. So there, and I mentioned earlier that Calhoun had been a nationalist at one time. He had favored strong national central government. He'd also favored high protective tariffs. Now here he is, you know, riding against the tariff, but back in the teens, he was very much a promoter of the 1816 tariff, the first high protective one. What changed his mind? It's not so much party as it is, it's an economic, geographic thing. If in his early years he was for a strong central national government and high protective tariff, becomes a states' rights advocate. But why did he favor a high protective tariff? He also sponsored the bank in the early days. What centered him on this nationalist kick? Did I cover that? Being a war hawk was one contributing factor. Those who favored the War of 1812 felt a sense of national identity and pride, but it's political in this sense. With so much cotton being grown in South Carolina, it was his expectation that textile mills would move to and set up in South Carolina. Therefore, such high protective tariffs would bring profits to those mill owners. Instead, by the 1820s, it became obvious that it was cheaper just to grow the material and send it up to mills up north or out to England. So from that point, no longer is a high protective tariff benefiting Southerners, it is costing Southerners, because it means that Southerners pay the way a tariff would work is, English sell their goods in the market probably cheaper and probably higher quality than the ones made in New England. But once that tariff got attached to it, then they cost more than the ones made up in New England. So it's all, for the most part, benefiting New England mills. One could argue that it helps the whole country because it keeps the money in the country and generates wealth, but first and foremost, it helps the mill owners and the workers up in New England. And it costs consumers, especially Southern consumers, more. So they're subsidizing Northern mill owners. When it was going to be South Carolinian mill owners, they were glad to subsidize them. But when it ends up being Northerners, he's opposed to it. So that's why he and South Carolinians are against this tariff. So the issue of the exposition and protest, in hopes of not necessarily nullifying, but threatening that they can nullify, so that Congress will, in response to that threat, lower the tariff. So from 1828, 29, 30 on through there, there is this expectation and pressure coming from South Carolina and other southern states to lower this tariff. In 1830, here is something that is not on your test, and therefore I should be real careful and not wade into this, that might be of some interest to you. In 1830, two events occur, neither of them on our quiz or test. The two events occur, which help facilitate this story a bit. There was a debate in the Senate that took place in January. It's in your textbook, it's well spelled out in the book, called the Webster-Hayne debate. And what it involved was Robert Hayne, senator from South Carolina, had been tutored by Calhoun to be ready for the opportunity to lower the tariffs in this fashion, which is what he said. He said, if possible, you should ally Southern interests with Western interests against Northeastern interests. Here's how you can argue this. You can say, Northeasterners always want to raise the price of land out west. Why would that be? That is true. Why would Northeasterners want to raise?
So they have more land, people would stay in the Northeast.
Yes, and if they stay in the Northeast, what happens?
Their land would
get more money. Their values would go up, as well as they'd be workers in the factories, and more workers means what on wages? Yes. So factory owners would be able to pay cheaper wages and have more valuable land as a result of keeping people from moving west. So what Calhoun tells Hayne is you should try to build an alliance with western states on the argument that Northeasterners manipulate federal power and profit at our expense through high tariffs. We all pay for things. Through high land prices, they gain off of you. Therefore, why don't you suggest that just like we've threatened to nullify tariffs, they could nullify land prices. What he's really trying to do is build a case for nullification with a majority of the sections for it. So in January of 1830, a situation arose when a Connecticut senator tried to propose a bill that would raise land prices. Hayne gets up, makes a speech, talks about his Western brethren and how much they have in common by being abused by Northeastern consolidation. But the spokesperson for the Northeastern group is Massachusetts Senator Daniel Webster. And Webster gets up and starts to talk not about land prices or about sections, but about the concept of nullification itself and how illegal and unconstitutional it is. And that's where it's remembered is that Daniel Webster out-debated Hayne on the difference between state versus federal sovereignty. That's a little later. In 1856, we'll come to that one. That's another one of those well-remembered things. So, and Daniel Webster was already remembered for his oratorical skills, and so it was considered one of the greatest and strongest Senate orations concerning the fact that a Supreme Court, not states, are the ones that should be able to overturn laws, federal laws. And one of the comments that Webster ended with was something like, our federal union, its glorious ensign waving leaving in the sunlight and as beams of sun speckle. I can't remember the whole speech, but it was a very moving, kind of poetic way of saying we should all have pride and respect the federal union.
Liberty union, now and forever, one and inseparable.
Now, is that his comments, or is that the one? All right, read that statement. I'm glad you got it.
Liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable.
I'm glad you had the quote, because the reason it applies is, in April of 1830, there is the Jefferson Day dinner, which occurs. You have that with it, too?
I haven't read that far yet.
Okay.
No, I don't think so.
Well, I'm glad you had the quote, because in the Jefferson Day dinner, this was one of those annual party celebration dinners they have, and everybody salutes the founders. At that dinner, Jackson and Calhoun are at such odds with each other. Jackson heard that Calhoun was going to raise a toast to states' rights and nullification. So Jackson tries to one-up him by raising his glass first and saying, our federal union, it must be preserved, trying to draw from the eloquence of that speech. To which Calhoun came back to him and said, our federal union next to our liberties most dear. So Calhoun had not been browbeat by Jackson. But what really happened here is by the early spring of 1830, these two men are not talking to each other anymore. They are at odds over the tariff issue, they're at odds over the Crawford letter, and obviously over the O'Neill affair. So neither of those two things are on the test. That's why I didn't put them on the sheets to prevent myself from talking about it. But it helps build the climate here. You can see after 1830, there is real bad blood between Jackson and Calhoun over tariffs and nullification. Again, what do South Carolinians and Calhoun want? They want to reduce lower tariffs. They don't want to nullify and go into a big, huge filibuster nuclear option fight like we're looking for this next week or doing here. They want just a lower tariff. So in 1832, Congress passes a new tariff here in item 49. But South Carolinians and Calhoun feel it's not low at all, it's an insult. So two things occur. Calhoun resigns from the vice presidency in protest of the tariff insult. And South Carolina moves from saying they could nullify to officially nullifying. So this is late 1832, after the re-election of Jackson. So Calhoun resigns the vice presidency. He's not a candidate for re-election anyway. And South Carolina implemented and made official that no tariffs will be collected in their state. He's not the only vice president to resign. There's been one other. Anybody remember who? They made watches for him, like Mickey Mouse watches. It was Nixon's vice president. He was a Greek-American governor of Maryland before he was vice president.
What?
Anybody remember this guy? If you remember this, he was brought to court on charges of bribery and tax evasion, and his punishment was, I'll resign if you don't can me. So they let him resign and drop charges. And then a couple of years later, dredged up some new ones on him after he was out of office.
He got pardoned by Nixon.
He just took the deal, according to vice presidency. That was October 8th, 1973, when he resigned. The reason I remember that, I was in Japan at the time on a religious thing and was reading the English version of the Mainichi News, and it said, Mr. Law and Order falls. I was talking about Agnew. I thought, wow. Spiro T. Agnew is who it was. So those are the two vice presidents that resigned. Well, what's a president to do here when a southern state declares it will not enforce federal law? Well, before we get to that, one other thing. Do you remember how senators were selected before 1913? State legislatures appointed them or selected them. They ask the junior senator of South Carolina, I forgot his name, was not the other one besides Hayne, to resign so that Calhoun could be appointed in his place. So right after the resignation as vice president, the legislature appoints Calhoun now to be a senator, so he's back there fighting for nullification in the Senate floor, in an in-your-face type approach, Jackson. Well, if a state refuses to enforce federal law, like say, for example, oh, just hypothetically, state says black children can't go to school, like the Supreme Court says, yes, they can. What's the president? They send the military to enforce the federal law. So, what was Jackson to do? He was very much in the spirit of Washington dealing with the Whiskey Rebellion. He was going to, as commander-in-chief, take the militias, plural, to South Carolina, and he said in private conversations he intended to hang every South Carolinian legislator from a palmetto tree, which is a state tree there. And from his behaviors in Florida, it's not surprising that he admitted it. So, here is 32 turns into 33. This is the looming issue. And in February of 1833, on the advice of his cabinet, Jackson goes to the Congress and asks for authorization to invade. It's interesting because, I mean, he already was commander-in-chief and could have done so with that, so why is he getting congressional authorization? Legal cover for what might follow. Kind of like, say, if you claimed PT votes attacked your ship, you may go to Congress and ask for a Gulf resolution. Just justify it later. Well, at the same time that Congress is voting on and does pass what's called the Force Bill, authorizing Jackson, Jackson's real archenemy, more than Calhoun, the one that's always been more than him, Henry Clay, is working feverishly to find a way to undercut Jackson's invasion. One thing, he doesn't want to see the invasion take place, but he also doesn't want to see the political acclaim that Jackson will get from doing this. So Henry Clay, at the same time that the Force Bill is being voted on and passed, is also proposing something that will make the invasion unnecessary, a compromise tariff. This is an item 50. And he succeeds. So it's either same day or same days, plural, that the Force Bill is passed. Congress passes a compromise tariff reduction. Keep that quote with me, but you never want to want to today. Get there sometime. The tariff would be sliding downward over a 9-year period. So it wasn't immediate. It would give 9 years for industry to get used to less protectionism. It would also eventually please Southerners tired about the high tariffs. Congress passes the tariff. It is low, or it's forecasted to be low enough to please South Carolinians. So the South Carolinians accept the tariff and rescind the nullification order, making the invasion no longer necessary. But in one last act of defiance, the South Carolina legislature issues another nullification order, nullifying the Force Bill, which is just academic anyway. But. So what happens here is that just about every eligible voter in South Carolina joins the Whig Party because they all hate Jackson so much. Which is strange because the National Republican / Whig Party, as they have renamed themselves, is the party of high tariffs. So it is strange what political bedfellows come along. Item 51. Still in the year of 1832, other political, I hope you like politics, because that's what we're mired in here right now. 1832. Let's talk some about the Second National Bank. When was it chartered? Or rechartered, you could say. 1816. Same time as the high protective tariff. It's all that post-war of 1812 new upsurge.
First in 1836.
Yes. Supposed to end in 20 years lease, end in 36. Jackson was, when he ran for office in 24 and in 28, and again in 32, and he had little to say about many issues. He wasn't really an issue person, he was more of an image person. But when it was time to talk about what actual government, political, economic issue he had strong feelings about, the bank was one of them. That was something that he could wax and wane on. He'd hated the bank since 1819. The reason for it was in 1819, the first of a very severe panic. There was a number of panics in the 19th century. The first one was 1819. The second one was 1837. Occurred, and many now look at it and say it was pretty much the fault, or the actions, it's not fair to say fault, the actions of the Second National Bank. What had happened was the Second National Bank, remember its original purpose, to be a currency regulator, buy up bank notes and always be willing to come down and demand the redemption, and if the bank couldn't pay, then, so just the threat of the bank was supposed to make banks behave better. Well, when it was rechartered in 1816, it spent the years from 1816 to 1819 accruing resources and getting established, and privately owned banks by 1819 assumed that this bank was not going to exercise the regulatory authority that the first one had, which they were surprised with when all of a sudden it started demanding redemption and caused so many bank failures that it triggered the panic of 1819. Westerners especially suffered, and a number of friends of Jackson were in that bunch. So while he himself did not lose money as a result, he always blamed the Second National Bank as the cause of so many of his Western friends going under. So when he ran for office in 24, for presidency in 24 and 28, and again 32, it was always based on the idea that the bank is a monster. It is like an octopus. It's unconstitutional. It's illegal. It's unfair. It gives favors and special benefit to the wealthy. It even gives special profits and favors to foreign investors over Americans. Just a bad institution all the way around. And he had made this known throughout the years. So in 1832, Clay gets an idea. He says he knows if he waits for this bank to naturally expire in 1836, if Jackson's reelected, that's the end of his real second term. As a lame duck president, he has no qualms about vetoing a bank recharter. So what Clay figures out is, what if we call for the recharter 4 years early? Don't wait till 36. Try to get his lease extended in 32, right before the presidential election. Make it a campaign issue. That might be something that Jackson can't take the risk on. If he wants to win re-election, he may not want to go so far as to try to do it by vetoing the bank and surviving the fallout that comes with it. So Clay, before the election, calls for early recharter and makes it a campaign issue. Tries to draw back the memories to the time between 1811 and 1816 when the first bank expired and there was no discipline over the currency during a war situation. Asking the question, will Jackson put our country in economic trouble by vetoing? It's Clay's thinking. One of two things will occur. Jackson will be too afraid to veto the issue, so it'll pass. Or if Jackson vetoes it, they can use it as a political weapon, cause him to lose re-election, and when Clay becomes president, because he's going to be the candidate, they'll just recharter. So Clay is the National Republican, or Whig, if you want to use that name, party candidate. And he's running on early recharter of the bank, which is shoving Jackson into the opposite position for his re-election bid, his veto of the bank. Well, as it turns out, Jackson does veto the bank, and he turns it to his advantage. He builds a very strong veto message on all the points I said earlier. In fact, he campaigns on the idea that he has protected the common man from the wealthy elite, again, one more time, by vetoing his bank. And it worked to his advantage. The veto held, and he won re-election over Clay. There's some firsts that appear in this election in 1832. Item 52 includes some of them. It's the first time that popular vote not just counted, it's the first time the popular vote actually swayed electors. By 1832, both parties had agreed to what we said earlier, that the winner of the plurality of popular vote would win all the electoral votes in those states. Are you finding something different here?
Mm-hmm. know, I remember that being something I got confused about.
It wasn't state law yet. It was just between 28 and 32, as the parties developed, they had come to an unwritten agreement that whoever wins the plurality in each state would win all of the electors of that state. So the 32 elections, the first time we see that one occurring.
So before then, it was just...
Electors are free agents.
Yeah, electors could vote for whoever they wanted to.
If they cared about democracy, they could look at the mock popular vote and follow it, but they sure didn't have to, and it wouldn't cost them or the party any political side effects.
So now they have to vote for...
Now, like 2005, or now 1832?
1834.
Okay, yeah. It's by 1832, that's what they had agreed to. So that was the first. Another first about the 1832 election. It is the first time that we see delegated nominating conventions take place. All three parties, and I haven't mentioned the third party yet, but I will, all three parties will use them. In fact, the party I haven't mentioned yet first proposed nominating conventions, and it's the Whigs and Democrats who followed them. And our next first for 1832 is, it's the first time we see a party platform adopted. What's a party platform?
Isn't that what, like, the Whig Party will run under all the...
Yes. It is their list of issues, or, as they call them, planks, upon which they stand. And it was exactly that. The Whigs were the first to have a party platform with such exciting issues as a high protective tariff, with all the South Carolina voters on board, a rechartered bank, there's three main issues, rechartered bank, high protective tariff, what's that other issue? Hopefully it'll come to me before the test. There were, federal finance transports routes. Federal finance, like turnpikes and canals and toll roads, paid for by the federal government. Extension of the national road and more road building by federal money. So federal finance, internal improvement road building, high protective tariff, and a strong rechartered bank. All of those reflect kind of that refried federalist policies, a strong national economic policy. The Democrats didn't adopt a platform because theirs was just laissez-faire, let's don't do anything. Let's stop that. And the next, or the last first in this issue, was the appearance of the first third party. They're known as the Anti-Masons. If you've read about them, they're an interesting bunch. And I don't know a lot about the Masons, so as I touch on this, if you are a Mason, feel free to scold me firmly here, but the Masonic movement traces its origins back to the stonecutters of Jerusalem, my understanding is. But in more modern terms, it was a guild fraternal organization that existed throughout medieval into modern Europe. When people migrated to America in the first colonial days, the Masonic movement came with it. And by this time period, by the 1830s, it was generally seen in two ways. The thing that upset people the most was it was seen as kind of an elitist social club. It was like when you used to have very restricted membership in a country club and only special people could join up, that's kind of how the Masons were seen. So those who were not Masons always kind of thought the better business deals, the better opportunities go to the people who buddy up in the Mason movement, the rest of us are left out. Therefore, that's elitist and it's non-democratic. The other side of concerns and criticisms of the Masonic movement was what? Well, they were accused, maybe, I'll put the maybe up. They were accused of dabbling with the occult. This is definitely not the Masonic movement, but anybody ever watch Peggy Sue Got Married? Do you remember the scene where she goes back in time when she was a teenager? And she's trying to get back into her own time period, and the grandfather takes her to the lodge meetings, and they start kind of going through all this occultist behavior and hopes they can send her back to her time. that's kind of sarcastically trying to imply what people think about these secret fraternal orders. That's another name that's associated with my Chantillians. But more, of course, that always made things a little more esoteric and exciting for people to worry about. But the real concerns was they were an elitist organization that didn't, that cut business deals and then everybody was not available to. In 1826, maybe, somewhere in the mid-1820s, a man named William Morgan came out and said he was a former Mason. He had quit the organization, and he was in the process of building a manuscript which was going to be a tell-all of the secrets of the Mason, which is kind of one of the things that's a no-no, revealing inner secrets and rules and procedures, etc. And here he was going to publish it. It was almost kind of like if someone revealed all the magician's illusions, something that was put him in jeopardy. In fact, what happened was, first the manuscript disappeared, if there ever was one. Second, he disappeared, and then next, his body was found washed dead over Niagara Falls. So the obvious assumption that people started to throw about was that Masons had killed him and shot him up so he wouldn't reveal the secrets. Yeah, and so that's what triggered the creation of the anti-Mason movement. And by 1832, they were now into politics, running for president, with their candidate, William Wirt, the former attorney general for Monroe. They didn't win, but they started the idea of third-party movements. And most of the anti-Masons were in the party because of their strong egalitarian beliefs, anti-elitism, social equality. They ran in that election because Jackson was a Mason, and they wanted to make sure that Jackson didn't get reelected. So they had affinity to the Whigs, even though Clay was a Mason also. And they later joined up the Whig Party. And they brought, when the anti-Masons in the mid-1830s joined the Whig Party, what they brought with them was a firm anti-slavery attitude. So as we go from the 30s into the 40s, and we start to see anti-slavery, which is way too radical for 30s politics. In the 1840s, when the anti-slavery movement starts to become a discussion topic, it is the anti-Mason element of the Whig Party that brings that to the party. Here's a little bit of not on the test at all, just personal trivia. When my grandmother passed away in Christmas of 84, and we went to take care of her belongings, came across big old huge family Bible, which had in the front cover all of the family tree going back really way back in the 1700s. And as I was looking back through here, and it was family was all around, I came across in our family, the Haggard family. In 1832 was born a William Wirt Haggard. Some goosebumps I'm feeling now, I felt then, I thought, William Wirt Haggard. My family in Abilene, Texas were anti-Masons? So I went to everybody in the family and tried to explain to them the significance, and nobody wanted to hear this lecture. But I just thought that was so interesting that the West Texas family members, anti-Masons, Mason preacher. Well, item 53. Up until 1834, National Republicans was the name of the party, the opposition party to Jackson. But by 34, they had gained so many new converts, South Carolinians, who hated Jackson over the nullification crisis, people who had been on one side or the other of the bank issue, angry about the bank's veto, many people who had held jobs in Washington but who had been fired by Jackson through the spoils system, and just other people who had somehow been affected by Jackson's politics, or people who thought that he had acted too high-handed, like King Andrew I in the cartoon, as a dictator. As more and more elements joined the National Republican Party, sometimes not all on the same page at all on issues like road building and banks and tariffs, they found that their strength to win elections could be less on issues and more on let's all hate Jackson. So that's why they chose the name the Whig Party, to suggest, like English politics, that Jackson was a runaway, dangerous monarch, and just as the Whig Party tried to protect the English from the king, the Whig Party in America would protect the Americans from King Andrew I. That's why they adopted that name. And the Whig Party really only stayed together as long as they could hate Clinton, Jackson. That wasn't actually.
Freudian slip.
That's what. And after Jackson was dead, they hated Jackson a little longer. And finally, by around late 40s and early 1850s, they lost their reason for coalition, and mid 50s fell apart as a party. Well, the bank story doesn't stop there, though. Item 54. Even though the bank was vetoed in 32, it still has four more years of life left on it until 36. That's when it officially ends. The bank president after the 1832 election, Nicholas Biddle, has a scheme that he thinks will make it possible to force Jackson to reverse the veto. Looking at the outstanding loans, he discovers that a large amount of them, more of them, than the rest, are actually to Democratic Party members. Prominent Democratic Party members owe the bank money or are in arrears. And the bank had been letting them slide on payment, and then Biddle decides, if we suddenly put the screws to these people in a hurry, they're all going to run to screaming for help. So what she did, and when they came to Biddle and asked for extra time, he said, you go to Jackson, get that bank veto reversed, and you'll have all the time you need. So they did. They went to Jackson, and party members asked him to consider, if the bill comes up for recharter again, would you reverse your veto? Which Jackson says, this is exactly what I'm talking about. Here is the reason I vetoed the bank. Too much power in the hands of one person. Nicholas Biddle can cause so much crisis that he can, through the threat of economic depression, force a change in government policy. That's too much power. So I'm not satisfied now to wait till 1836 to kill this bank. I'll kill this monster early. So what Jackson does is he instructs the Secretary of the Treasury to remove all the government funds, which I don't know exactly the percentage, but it was a greater proportion than the first bank. Remove all the government funds and place them in private banks. Well, two different, a Secretary of Treasury, a Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, and then an Acting Secretary of the Treasury appointed to replace those two, all tried explaining to Jackson, this is not good economic policy. If you move all this government money out of the bank, it'll be like 1811 again. There'll be no discipline over private banks. Plus, a lot of these private banks will be sitting on a lot of new funds that they can print paper notes on with no discipline. They're all fired. Finally, a fourth one, a man named Roger Taney, who will come back in even more famous events later, T-A-N-E-Y. Roger Taney will do as Jackson wishes and move the money from the National Bank into what are called pet banks. They're called pet banks because when Jackson asked for a list of banks, where this money could go to, they were not drawn up on the basis of sound behavior, they're drawn up on the basis of who are the closest friends of the party. Spoil system at work. The money is moved into these banks. At the same time, not on our quiz, not on our test, at the same time, Clay has been maneuvering Congress to take the surplus that existed and distribute it back to states. They finally paid off the Revolutionary War debt and were saving more money than they were spending. Clay got that bill passed. So the surplus of federal money is now going to be, according to population, distributed out to each state. Clay wanted that so states could use that money to build roads. So there's government money going to the states through a distribution bill. There are now banks with a lot more government money sitting on it that can print up paper notes with no discipline to stop them. Between 1834 and 1836, there is a rapid inflationary spiral taking place. And it's all really due, most of it's due to Jackson's killing of the bank. Much of the inflation is due to a land speculative boom. People are out buying western lands from the federal government with these banknotes. So sheepishly, administration officials finally come to Jackson. They don't want to come right out and say, you've caused this panic, but they say you've got to do something to solve it. So what Jackson does on advice is to issue an executive order, which declares that all federal lands must be purchased in hard currency, or as the word is used, specie. It's called the specie circular. So gold and silver coinage is the only thing that can buy this land. You can't use a banknote to buy federal land. The specie circular not only stops the inflationary spiral, it throws the economy into a reverse recession, causing, as 35 shows, the panic of 1837. Which won't haunt Jackson, because he's finishing his term. But his vice president, Martin Van Buren, that's the one who replaced Calhoun in the 32 election, Martin Van Buren was hoping to, on the coattail effects of Jackson, win the 36th election and have an easy time. Well, he does win the 36th election, but just as he's inaugurated, the panic of 1837 strikes, and it's 37 to 40 economic hard times that completely haunt the Van Buren presidency. So while historians clearly stake the 1837 panic on Jacksonomics, it never comes to politically haunt Jackson. In the 36th election, in item 56, before that panic hit, Van Buren was the Democratic candidate. Vice President.
It's not in the notes.
It's not in the notes, but I should know. Oh, well. Should know, though. Oh, well, anyway. Van Buren runs and wins, 36th election. The Whig candidate is actually four candidates. This is because they hold no convention, they're out of unity with each other, and four different candidates all want to be, so they all declare themselves. And the party, which didn't want that to be the way of things, hopes that maybe it can result in the 1824 experience. No clear winner of electoral votes, split in so many directions that it goes to the House, where they believe they can have more influence. Well, it doesn't. In fact, let's get the candidates out. Daniel Webster of Massachusetts was a Whig candidate. 36. Trying to figure out who that vice president was. Yeah. Clay is a candidate. Hold on. Before I say that, let me stop and think. Stop thinking about Van Buren's vice president. Do the facts correctly. Daniel Webster of Massachusetts, candidate. William Henry Harrison of Indiana is a candidate. Hugh L. White of Tennessee is a candidate. And Robert Mangum is a candidate. Clay is not. Pretty bad set. Mangum is South Carolina. I just remembered who it was because it's part of the story. It's Richard M. Johnson, the guy that killed Tecumseh. And so-called curse. In fact, Johnson's the one that he's the only vice president to be elected by the Senate because there was no clear winner of electoral votes for the vice presidential candidates. And Van Buren's running mate Johnson was confirmed by the Senate. Item 57. So 4 years later, in the 1840 election, it doesn't look good for Van Buren because his whole presidency has been one of panic. In some ways, economically, you can parallel Van Buren to Hoover in this regards that previous party policies led to an economic decline that he pays for and loses re-election on. So in 1840, Van Buren runs against the Whigs again. This time the Whigs get their act together and unite behind one candidate, William Henry Harrison, whose campaign slogan, as it's listed here, is Tippecanoe and Tyler too. Tippecanoe alluding back to the Battle of 1811. fight, Tecumseh and McLaughlin. He's the oldest man to run, we've been through this before, but he's the oldest man to run for president, doing so at age 68. Reagan will be older at 69. His running mate, John Tyler, was a Virginia Democrat, not a Whig. Reason for it was Tyler had been disgusted with Jackson for having fired some of his close friends that worked in Washington. So, victim of the spoils system, that's why Tyler joined the Whig coalition against Jackson. But the key point here is that Tyler is issue-wise still a Democrat. He may be anti-Jackson, but he's a states' rights, laissez-faire person, not a large national government. Harrison gives a lengthy inaugural address in bad weather and catches a cold which turns into pneumonia and dies within a month and a half, the shortest sitting president. And therefore, John Tyler, a Democrat, who was only on the ticket to defeat Democrats, is now president, maybe? That's the question mark. Henry Clay, Speaker of the House, who considers himself the real leader of government, comes to Tyler and says, this is our first test case situation here, and I think it's all clear that you're not really the president. You're just carrying out presidential duties until the next election. So I know you're overwhelmed and swamped anyway, so I'll run government for you. Clay conversation, which Tyler says not the case whatsoever. I am the president. He makes sure that the National Archivist swears him in and makes him the numbered president next. So through just force of will and character, Tyler makes official that he is not just carrying out the duties, he is the next president. And he makes it clear to Clay that he's leader of the party. Clay makes it clear to Tyler he's leader of the party by demanding all his cabinet resign. And they do, except for one. So all these people who had been Harrison cabinet members follow Clay's orders and resign, except for the Secretary of State, Daniel Webster. And it wasn't because Webster had any great loyalty to Tyler. Webster had started right from day one serious negotiations with the British that he wanted to complete before he resigned. And that finally results in 1842, the Webster-Ashburton Treaty of 58. The Webster-Ashburton Treaty has much to do with jurisdictional disputes with Britain. In three areas, Niagara Falls, the Atlantic, and Minnesota and New Brunswick. Back to the issue where I lost the game on the bus and Germany. Remember that story? That kind of story?
I may not be thinking
of it.
He was right and I was wrong and I made him call him up and he lost and we had it back to do with that. Yes. An incident that occurred in Niagara Falls, patrolling the slave trade on the Atlantic Ocean, and border disputes in Minnesota and New Brunswick. We can do the land one first. The border was unclear here at Lake of the Woods in Minnesota and unclear here where Maine and New Brunswick was. And it was, Webster is trying his best to get the best deal he can with the British to gain more land from Canada than the other way around. What had created the New Brunswick situation of currency was a conflict which didn't result in any deaths, some injuries, of Canadian and American lumberjacks chasing each other and cutting each other with axes. Nobody got killed. And it was all over whose area, what forest area belongs to whom. Aristic War, as it was called. And what was finally agreed upon is what is here. There's this dispute settled in 1842, as well as the Lake of the Woods dispute. Canadian situation. This is one that's not on the quiz and I never understand it when I tell them, but apparently what happened was a group of Canadian rebels who wanted to overthrow British rule of Canada, they were more terrorists than they were serious rebels, had captured and burned the British ship and let it float over Niagara Falls on fire. Came across the boundary to Buffalo, New York, came into a bar, drank too much, bragged about it. Someone in the bar went back and told British officials in Canada that the people that set the boat on fire and watched over are bragging about it and drunk in a bar in America. So Canadian officials came across the boundary and arrested them in the American bar and took them back to Canada, which was a violation of our jurisdiction. The other incidences, which were a little more serious than all this, had to do with international slave trade violations. Two cases. One was called the Creole, which is not on here. The other one's the Amistad, which there was a movie made about. This has to do with people who were violating both the British and American slave trade laws, which is illegal at this point, still buying and selling African slaves and bringing them over to the Caribbean and disembarking them. What would happen is the British Navy, which was much stronger than the American Navy, often would find Americans involved in this activity and would arrest them. To which the U.S. government would say, while we don't allow the slave trade, you don't have on international waters the jurisdiction to arrest our people. Not actually part of the Webster-Ashburton Treaty, but still bringing attention to this issue was the Amistad case, where slaves took over a British ship, tried to get the crew to sail them back to Africa, but the crew tricked them and sailed up to New York City. When they got to New York City, the American government arrested the slaves for stealing themselves as cargo. The leader of the slave revolt, a guy named Cinq, C-I-N-Q-U-E, which is five in French, contacted John Quincy Adams, who by this time now in the 1840s is nearly in his 80s, and asked him to defend them in federal courts. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and John Quincy Adams was able to get the crew of the Amistad freed in the Supreme Court. There's a Spielberg movie called Amistad, which deals with this, which is wonderful. But the main thing you need to know is that the Webster-Ashburton Treaty settled jurisdictional disputes with Britain in Canada, on the Atlantic, and with the Niagara Falls incident. And then after that, Webster resigned also, leaving Tyler with... Couldn't find anybody to serve. Finally got some much nondescript lower level echelon people to serve, but the Tyler presidency was pretty much a disaster. That leaves us a sheet left to do. Why don't we do that when we come back?